Chapter 2. Karis threaded tape to an empty reel on a table in the office of Frank Miranda, the rotund, silver-haired director of the Institute of Languages and Linguistics. Having edited sections of both his tapes onto separate reels, Karis started the tape recorder, and the two men listened with headphones to the fevered voice croaking gibberish. When it ended, Karis slipped the headphones onto his shoulders and asked, "Frank, what is that? Could it possibly be a language?" His earphones off as well, Miranda was sitting on the edge of his desk, his arms folded as he stared at the floor and frowned in puzzlement. "I don't know," he said, shaking his head. "Pretty weird." He glanced up at Karis. "Where'd you get that?" "I'm working on a case of dual personality." "You're kidding me. A priest?" "I can't say." "Oh, yeah, of course. I understand." "Well, what about it, Frank? You do it?" Staring off thoughtfully, Miranda gently lifted off his tortoiseshell reading glasses, absently folding and then slipping them into the slim lapel pocket of his seersucker jacket. "No, it isn't any language that I've ever heard," he said. "However," slightly frowning, he glanced up at Karis. "You want to play that again?" Karis rewound the tape, replayed it, turned off the recorder and said, "Okay, any ideas?" Well, I must say it does have the cadence of speech." A sudden quickening of hope arose in the Jesuit, brightening his eyes for an instant, and then dimming as he reflexively fought down the hope. "But I don't recognize it, Father," the director continued. "Is it ancient, modern? I don't know." "Well, come on, why not leave it with me, Father? I'll check it much more thoroughly with some of the boys. Maybe one of them will know what it is." "Well, could you please make a copy of it, Frank? I'd like to keep the original myself." "Oh, yeah, sure. In the meantime, I've got another tape. You got the time?"
"Yeah, sure. Go ahead."
"Tape of what?" "Well, let me ask you something first."
"Yeah, what?"
"Frank, what if I were to give you samples of ordinary speech by what are apparently two different people? Could you tell by semantic analysis whether just one person might have been capable of both modes of speech?"
"Oh, I think so. Yeah, sure.
A type-token ratio, I suppose, would be as good a way as any to work that out. And with samples of 1,000 words or more, you could just check the frequency of occurrence of the various parts of speech."
"And would you call that conclusive?"
"Oh, yeah, pretty much. You see, that sort of test would discount any change in the basic vocabulary. It's not the words, but the expression of the words, the style. We call it index of diversity."
"Very baffling to the layman, which, of course, is what we want."
The director smiled wryly. Then he nodded at the tape in Karis's hands.
"And so, this other person's voice is on that one?"
"Not exactly."
"Not exactly?"
"The voices and the words on both tapes came out of the mouth of one and the same person." The director's eyebrows rose.
"The same person?"
"Yeah. As I said, it was a case of dual personality. Now, Frank, could you compare them against one another for me? I mean, the voices sound totally different, but I'd still like to see what a comparative analysis would show."
The director looked intrigued, even pleased. He said,
"Fascinating."
"Yes, we'll run the analysis."
"I'm thinking maybe now I'll give it to Paul. He's my top instructor. Brilliant mind. I think he dreams in Indian code talk."
"One more favor, Frank. It's a big one."
"Yeah? What?"
"I'd prefer it if you did the comparison yourself."
"Oh?"
"Yeah.
And as quickly as possible. Please." The director read the urgency in Karis's voice and in his eyes.
"Okay," he said, nodding.
"Okay, I'll get on it." Returning to his room in the Jesuit residence hall,
Karras found a message slip under his door. Reagan's records from Barringer Clinic had arrived. Karras hurried to reception, signed for the package, returned to his room, sat down at his desk and started avidly reading. But at the end, as he read the conclusion of the clinic's psychiatric team, his mood of hopeful anticipation had slipped into one of disappointment and defeat. Indications of guilt, obsession with ensuing hysterical, somnambulistic, needing to read no more, Karras stopped, propped his elbows on the desk, and with a sigh, slowly lowered his face into his hands. Don't give up. Don't give up. Room for doubt, interpretation. But in the matter of Reagan's skin stigmata, which, according to the records, had recurred again repeatedly while Reagan had been under observation at Barringer, the clinic's summary analysis had noted that Reagan had hyperreactive skin and could herself have produced the mysterious letters by tracing them on her flesh with a finger a short time prior to their appearance by a process known as dermatographia, a theory buttressed by the fact that as soon as Reagan's hands had been immobilized by restraining straps, the mysterious phenomena ceased. Karras lifted his head and eyed the telephone. Frank. Was there really any point now in running a comparison of the voices on the tapes? Call him off? Yeah, I should, the priest concluded. He picked up the receiver, dialed. No answer. He left word for the institute director to call, and then, exhausted, he stood up and walked slowly to his bathroom, where he splashed cold water onto his face. The exorcist will simply be careful that none of the patient's manifestations are left unexplained. Karras worriedly looked up at himself in the mirror. Had he missed something? What? The sauerkraut odor? He turned and slipped a towel off the rack and wiped his face. No, autosuggestion would explain that, he recalled, as well as reports that in certain instances, the mentally ill seemed able to unconsciously direct their bodies to emit a variety of odors. Karras wiped his hands. The poundings, the opening and the closing of the drawer. Was that psychokinesis? Really? You believe in that stuff? Becoming suddenly aware that he was not thinking clearly, Karras set the damp towel back on its bar. You're tired. Too tired. Yet the core of his being refused to give up, to surrender this child to sinuous theories and speculations, to the blood-drenched history of betrayals of the human mind. He left the residence hall and walked swiftly up Prospect Street to the gray stone walls of Georgetown University's Lowenger Library, entered, and searched through the Guide to Periodical Literature, running a finger down subjects beginning with P. And after finding what it was that he'd been looking for, he sat down at a long oaken reading table with a scientific journal containing an article about poltergeist phenomena. Was written by the eminent German psychiatrist, Dr. Hans Bender. No doubt about it, the Jesuit concluded when he'd finished reading the article. Having for many years been thoroughly documented, filmed, and observed in psychiatric clinics, psychokinetic phenomena were real. But in none of the cases reported in the article was there any connection to demonic possession. Rather, the favorite hypothesis explaining the phenomenon was mind-directed energy, unconsciously produced and usually and significantly, Karras noted, by adolescents in stages of extremely high inner tension, rage, and frustration. Karras lightly rubbed his knuckles into the corner of his moist and tired eyes, and still feeling remiss, he ran back through Reagan's symptoms, touching each like a schoolboy, making sure that he taps every slat as he walks along a white picket fence. Karras wondered which one he had missed. The answer, he wearily concluded, was none. He walked back to the McNeil house where Willie admitted him and led him to the door of the study. It was closed. Willie knocked.
"Father Karras,"
she announced, and from within Karras heard a subdued, "Come in." Karras entered and closed the door behind him. Standing with her back to him, Chris had an elbow propped on the bar top and her forehead lowered into a hand. Without turning, she greeted him. "Hello, Father," in a voice that was husky, yet soft and despairing. Concerned, the priest went to her side.
"Chris, you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine, Father, really."
Karras frowned, his worry deepening. Chris's voice had held tension, and the hand that was obscuring her face was trembling. Lowering her arm, she turned and looked up at Karras, revealing a haggard-eyed, tear-stained face.
"So what's doing?" she said. "What's new?"
Karras studied her before answering. "Well, the latest is I've looked at the record from Barringer Clinic."
"Yeah?"
"Well, I believe..."
"You believe what, Father Karras? Come on, what?"
"Well, my honest opinion right now is that Reagan can best be helped by intensive psychiatric care." Chris stared at Karras mutely, and with her eyes a little wider as she very slowly shook her head back and forth. "No way." "Where's her father?" Karras asked.
"In Europe."
"Have you told him what's happening?"
"No."
"Well, I think it would help if he were here."
"Listen, nothing's going to help except something out of sight,"
Chris erupted in a voice that was loud and quavery. "I believe you should send for him."
"Why?"
"It would..."
"I've asked you to drive a demon out, goddammit, not ask another one in!"
Chris's features contorted in anguish. "What happened to the exorcism all of a sudden?
Look, what in the hell do I want with Howard?"
"We can talk about that later when..."
"Talk about it now, goddammit! What the hell good is Howard right now?"
"Well, there's probably a strong probability that Reagan's disorder is rooted in guilt..."
"Guilt over what?" Chris squalled, her eyes wild.
"It could..."
"Over the divorce, over that psychiatric bullshit?"
"Now,
Reagan feels guilty because she killed Burke Dennings!"
Chris shrieked, her hands lifted and fists pressed against her temples.
"She killed him! She killed him, and they'll put her away! They're going to put her away! Oh, my God!"
Karras caught her up as she crumpled, sobbing, and guided her toward the sofa. "It's all right," he kept telling her softly. "It's all right."
"No, they'll put her away!
"It's all right." Karras eased Chris down and helped her to stretch out on the sofa. Then he sat on its edge and took her hand in both of his. Racing thoughts now, of Kinderman, of Dennings, Chris sobbing on reality. "All right, it's all right, take it easy, take it easy. It's all going to be okay." Soon the crying subsided, and he helped her sit up. He brought her water and a box of tissues that he'd found on a shelf behind the bar. And then he sat down beside her.
"Oh, I'm glad,"
Chris said, sniffling and blowing her nose. "You're glad?"
"Yeah, I'm glad I got it out."
"Oh, well, yes, that's good." And now again the weight pressed heavily down on the Jesuit's shoulders. "No more. Say no more," he tried warning himself, yet. "Do you want to tell me more?" he asked Chris gently. Chris nodded mutely, and then, weakly, she said,
"Yes,
yes, I do." She wiped at an eye and began to speak haltingly and in spasms of Kinderman, of the narrow strips torn from the edges of the witchcraft book,
and of a certainty that Dennings had been up in Reagan's bedroom on the night he had died, of Reagan's abnormally great strength, and of the Dennings personality, Chris thought she had seen, with its head turned around and facing backward. Finished, depleted, she waited for Karras's reaction, and just as he was about to tell her his mind, he looked into her eyes and her beseeching expression, and instead said, "You can't be really sure that she did it. What, Burke's head turned around? The things it says?" "Well, you'd hit your own head pretty hard against the wall," Karras answered. "You were also in shock. You imagined it." Holding Karras's gaze with dead eyes, Chris said quietly, "No. Burke told me that she did it. She pushed him out the window, and she killed him." Momentarily stunned, the priest stared at her blankly, but then gathered himself. "Your daughter's mind is deranged," he said. "And so her statements mean nothing." Chris lowered her head and shook it. "I don't know," she said, barely audibly. "I don't know if I'm doing what's right. I think she did it, and so maybe she could kill someone else. I don't know." She turned a hopeless, hollow stare back to Karras, and in a throaty, husky whisper, she asked him, "What should I do?" Karras inwardly sagged. The weight was now set in concrete, and in drying it had shaped itself to his back. "Well, you've already done what you should do," he said. "You've told someone, Chris. You've told me. So now just leave it up to me to decide what's best to do. Would you do that, please? Just leave it to me?" Wiping at an eye with the back of her hand, Chris nodded and said, Yeah. Well, sure. Sure, yeah. Yeah, that would be best, Father." Trying to muster a smile, she added weakly, "Thanks, Father. Thank you so much." "Are you feeling better now?"
"Yes."
"Then will you do me a favor?"
"Sure, anything. What?"
"Go out and see a movie." For a moment, Chris stared blankly. And then she smiled and shook her head. "Nah, I hate him."
"Go visit a friend."
Chris looked at him warmly. "I got a friend right here." "You bet. Now you get some rest, please. Will you promise?"
"Yes, I promise."
Karras had a thought, another question. "You think Dennings brought the book upstairs?" he asked. "Or was it already there?"
"I believe it was there."
Looking slightly aside, Karras nodded his head.
"I see," he said quietly.
Then abruptly he stood up.
"Well, okay. You need the car back, by the way?"
No, you can keep it."
"All right, then. I'll be back to you later."
Lowering her head, Chris said softly,
"Okay."
Karras left the house and walked out onto the street with thoughts that raced and tumbled recklessly in his mind. Reagan killed Dennings? What madness! He envisioned her shoving him out through her bedroom window to hurtle down those long and steep stone steps, turning over and over and flailing helplessly until his world came to a sudden stop.
Impossible, thought Karras. No!
And yet Chris's near conviction it was so. Her hysteria.
Well, that's exactly what it is. The priest tried telling himself. That's it. It's nothing more than hysterical imagining.
And yet, Karras chased after certainties, like fallen leaves in a wind. As he was passing the precipitous steps beside the house, Karras heard a sound from below by the river, and he stopped and looked down toward the C&O Canal. A harmonica. Someone playing Red River Valley. Since boyhood, the Jesuits' favorite song. He stood and listened until the traffic light changed down below, and the melancholy melody was crushed and overwhelmed by the sound of auto traffic starting up again on M Street, rudely shattered by a world that was now, of this moment and in torment, dripping blood on exhaust fumes as it cried out for help. Staring down the steps unseeingly, Karras thrust his hands into his pockets, as once again he thought feverishly about the plight of Chris McNeil and of Reagan and of Lucas aiming kicks at the dead tranquil. He must do something, but what? Could he hope to outguess the clinicians at Barringer? Oh, are you really a priest or from Central Casting? Karras absently nodded, remembering the case of possession of a Frenchman named Achille who, like Reagan, had called himself a devil, and like Reagan, his disorder had been rooted in guilt. In Achille's case, remorse over marital infidelity. The great psychologist Janet had effected a cure by hypnotically suggesting the presence of the wife, who appeared to Achille's hallucinated eyes, and solemnly forgave him. Karras nodded. Yes, suggestion could work for Reagan, although not through hypnosis. They had tried that at Barringer. The counteracting suggestion for Reagan, he believed, was what her mother had insisted on all along. It was the ritual of exorcism. Reagan knew what it was, and she knew its intended effect, her reaction to the holy water. She got that from a chapter in that book, and in that chapter there were also descriptions of successful exorcisms. Yes, it could work. It could. But then how to get permission from the Chancery Office? How to build up a case without mention of Dennings? Karras could not lie to the bishop. And so what facts did he have that could possibly convince him? His temples beginning to pulse with headache, Karras lifted a hand to his brow. He knew he needed sleep, but he couldn't. No, not now. What facts? The tapes at the Institute? What would Frank find? Was there anything he could find? No! Oh, wait, who knows? Who knows? Maybe. Reagan hadn't known holy water from tap water. Sure, but if supposedly she's able to read my mind, why is it she didn't know the difference between them? Karras again put a hand to his forehead. The headache, confusion. Come on, kid. Somebody's dying. Wake up. Once back in his room, Karras telephoned the Institute. No Frank. Pensive, he set down the receiver. Holy water, tap water, what? Something. He opened up the ritual to instructions to exorcists. Evil spirits, deceptive answers. So it might appear that the afflicted one is in no way possessed. What about that? Was that it? Karras wondered. But then instantly he bridled with impatience at the thought. What in the hell are you talking about? What evil spirit? He slammed shut the book and then reread the medical records, scanning through them in a hurried, fevered search for anything that might help him make the case for an exorcism. Hey, here's one. No history of hysteria. Ha! All right, that's something, but it's weak. There's something else here, he remembered. Some discrepancy. What? What was it? And then he recalled it. Oh, not much. Still, it's something. He telephoned Chris McNeil. She sounded groggy.
Oh, hi, Father.
Were you sleeping? I'm sorry.
No, no, no. It's okay, Father. Really. So what's up?
Chris, where can I find this? Karras ran a finger down the records, stopped.
Dr. Klein, he said, Samuel Klein. Oh, Doc, yeah. He's across the bridge. He's in Rosalind.
In the medical building?
Yeah, right. What's the matter?
Please call him and tell him Dr. Karras will be by and that I'd like to take a look at Reagan's EEG. Important. Tell him Dr. Karras. Got it. When he'd hung up the phone, Karras snapped off his collar and got out of his clerical robe and black trousers, changing quickly into khaki pants and a sweatshirt, and over these he wore his priest's black raincoat. But then, examining himself in a mirror, Karras frowned and thought, priests and policemen, they had identifying auras that they couldn't hide. Karras slipped off the raincoat, then his shoes, and got into the only ones he owned that weren't black, a pair of scuffed white tree-torn tennis shoes. In Chris's car, he drove quickly toward Roslyn. As he waited on M Street for the light to change at Key Bridge, he glanced to his left through the windshield and saw Carl getting out of a black sedan parked in front of the Dixie liquor store. The driver of the car was Kinderman. The light changed. Karras gunned the car forward, turning onto the bridge, then looked back through the mirror. Had they seen him? No, he didn't think so. But what were they doing together? Had it something to do with Reagan, he worried? With Reagan and... Forget it. One thing at a time. He parked at the medical building and went upstairs to Dr. Klein's suite of offices. The doctor was busy, but a nurse handed Karras the EEG, and very soon he was standing in a cubicle, scrolling through the long, narrow band of graphed paper slipping slowly through his fingers. Klein hurried in, his glance briefly brushing over Karras's dress. You're, Dr. Karras? Yes. Oh, Sam Klein, pleased to meet you. As they shook hands, Klein asked, How's the girl? Oh, progressing. Ah, glad to hear it. Karras looked back at the graphs, and Klein joined him in scanning it, tracing his finger over patterns of waves. There you see, it's very regular. No fluctuations whatever, Klein noted. Yes, I do see that. Curious. Curious? How so? Well, presuming that we're dealing with hysteria. What do you mean? No. Suppose it isn't very well known, Karras answered, as he kept pulling paper through his hands in a steady flow. But a Belgian named Iteka discovered that hysterics seemed to cause some rather odd fluctuations in the graph. A very minuscule but always identical pattern. I've been looking for it here, and I don't see it. Klein grunted noncommittally. How about that? Karras stopped scrolling and looked up at him. She was certainly disordered when you ran this graph, is that right? Oh, yeah, I'd say. Yes, she was. Well, then isn't it curious that she tested so perfectly? Even subjects in a normal state of mind can influence their brain waves, you know that, at least within the normal range. And as Reagan was disturbed at the time, wouldn't it seem there'd be some fluctuations? If, Doctor, Mrs. Simmons is getting impatient, a nurse interrupted, cracking open the door. Okay, I'm coming, Klein told her. As the nurse hurried off, he took a step toward the hallway, but then turned with his hand gripping the edge of the door. Speaking of hysteria, he commented dryly. Sorry, gotta run. He closed the door behind him. Karras heard his footsteps heading down the hall, the opening of a door, and then, Well now, how are we feeling today? The closing of the door shut off the rest. Karras went back to his study of the graph, and when he'd finished, he folded it up and banded it, then returned it to the nurse in reception. Something. It was something he could use with the bishop as an argument that Reagan was not a hysteric, and therefore conceivably could be possessed. And yet the EEG had posed still another mystery. Why no fluctuations? None. None at all. Karras drove back toward Chris's house, but at a stop sign at the corner of Prospect and 35th, he froze behind the wheel. Sitting in the driver's seat of a car that was parked between Karras and the Jesuit residence hall, was Kinderman, his elbow out the window, as he fixedly stared straight ahead. Karras took a right before the homicide detective could see him. He quickly found a space, parked, and locked the car, and then walked around the corner as if heading for the residence hall. Is he watching the house? Karras worried. The specter of Dennings rose up again to haunt him. Was it possible that Kinderman thought Reagan had... Easy, boy. Easy. Slow down. He walked up beside the car and leaned his head through the window on the passenger side. Hi, Lieutenant, he said pleasantly. Come to visit me, or you're just goofing off for a while? The detective turned quickly, looking surprised. And then he flashed a beaming smile. Why, Father Karras! Ah, so there you are. So nice to see you. Off-key, Karras thought. What's he up to? Don't let him know that you're worried. Play it light. Don't you know you'll get a ticket? Karras pointed to a sign. Weekdays, no parking between 4 and 6. Never mind, growled Kinderman. I'm talking to a priest. Every meter made in Georgetown is a Catholic.
Have you been?
Speaking plainly, Father Karras. Only so-so.
And yourself? Can't complain. Did you ever solve that case?
Which case?
The movie director.
Oh, that one. The detective made a gesture of dismissal. Don't ask, please. Listen, what are you doing tonight, Father? Come to think of it. Are you busy? I've got passes for the biograph. It's Othello.
Well, that depends on who's in it.
Who's in it? John Wayne Othello and Desdemona Doris Day. You're happy? This is freebies, Father Marlin, annoyingly particular. This is William F. Shakespeare. Doesn't matter who's starring and who's not. Are you coming?
I'm afraid I'll have to pass. I'm snowed under.
I could see that, the detective said as he searched the Jesuit's face.
You've been keeping late hours, Father?
You look terrible. I always look terrible. Yeah, only now more than usual. Come on now. Get away for one night. You'll enjoy.
Karras decided to test, to touch a nerve. Are you sure that's what's playing? He asked. Othello?
His eyes were probing steadily into the detective's.
I could have sworn there was a Chris McNeil film at the biograph. The detective missed a beat
and then said quickly, Oh, no, you're wrong. It's Othello.
Oh, okay.
So what brings you to the neighborhood? You. I came only to invite you to the film.
Yes, of course. It's easier to drive than to pick up a phone, I suppose.
The detective's eyebrows lifted in a dismally unconvincing stab at looking innocent.
Your telephone was busy.
The Jesuit stared at him silently and gravely. So what's wrong? Asked Kinderman.
What? Karras reached a hand inside the car, lifted Kinderman's eyelid and examined the eye.
I don't know, he said, frowning. You look terrible. You could be coming down with a case of mythomania. I don't know what that means. Is it serious?
Oh, yes, but not fatal.
What is it, Father? The suspense is now driving me crazy.
Look it up, Karras told him.
Listen, don't be so snotty. You should render unto Caesar just a little now and then. I'm the law. I could have you deported, you know that?
What for?
A psychiatrist shouldn't piss people off. Plus also the Goyim, plainly speaking, would love it. You're a nuisance to them, Father.
No, really, you embarrass them.
Who needs a priest who wears sweatshirts and sneakers? Smiling faintly, Karras nodded. Gotta go.
Take care.
He tapped a hand on the window frame twice in farewell, and then turned and walked slowly toward the entry of the residence.
See an analyst,
the detective called after him hoarsely. Then his warm look yielded to one of deep concern. He glanced up through his windshield at the house, then started the engine and drove up the street. Passing Karras, he honked his horn and waved. Karras waved back,
and when Kinderman's car turned the corner at 36th Street, he stopped and stood motionless for a time, rubbing gently at his brow with a trembling hand. Could she really have done it? Could Reagan have murdered Burke Denning so horribly? With feverish eyes, Karras turned and looked up at Reagan's window, thinking, what in God's name is in that house? And how much longer before Kinderman demanded to see Reagan, had a chance to see the Dennings' personality, to hear it? How much longer before Reagan would be institutionalized or die? He had to build the exorcism case for the chancery. He walked quickly across the street to the Chris McNeil house, rang the doorbell, and waited for Willie to let him in. Oh, Mrs. taking a little nap now, she said. Karras nodded. Oh, good. That's good. He walked by her and then upstairs to Reagan's bedroom. He was seeking a knowledge he must clutch by the heart. He entered and saw Carl in a chair by the window, silent and present as a dense dark wood. He was sitting with folded arms and with his stare pinned steadily to Reagan. Karras walked up beside the bed and looked down. The whites of the eyes like milky fog, the murmurings, incantations from some other world. Karras slowly leaned over and began to unfasten one of Reagan's restraining straps.
Well, no, Father, no!
Carl rushed to the bedside and vigorously yanked back the Jesuit's arm.
Very bad, Father. No. Strong. It's strong.
In Carl's eyes, there was a fear that Karras recognized as genuine. And now he knew that Reagan's extraordinary strength was a fact. She could have done it. She could have twisted Denning's neck around.
Come on, Karras. Hurry. Find some evidence. Think.
And then a voice from beneath him, on the bed.
Ich möchte Sie etwas fragen, Herr Engström.
With a stab of discovery and surging hope, Karras jerked around his head and looked down at the bed to see Reagan's demonic visage grinning at Carl.
Tanz Ihre Tochter gern?
It taunted, and then burst into mocking laughter. German. It had asked if Carl's club-footed daughter liked to dance. Excited, Karras turned to Carl and saw his cheeks were flushing crimson. Hands clenched into white-knuckled fists, he was glaring at Reagan with fury as the laughter continued.
Carl, you better step outside, Karras cautioned him. The Swiss shook his head. No, I stay.
You will go, please, Carl, the Jesuit said firmly, his gaze holding Carl's implacably until, after a moment or two more of resistance, the houseman abruptly turned and hurried out of the room. When the door closed, the laughter abruptly ceased to be replaced by that thick and airless silence. Karras turned his gaze to the bed. The demon was watching him. It looked pleased.
Ah, so you're back. I'm surprised. I would think the embarrassment over the holy water might have discouraged you from ever returning. But then I forget that a priest has no shame.
Karras took a few breaths as he forced himself to concentrate, to think clearly. He knew that the language test for possession required intelligent conversation as proof that whatever was said was not traceable to buried linguistic recollections.
Easy. Slow down. Remember that girl?
A Parisian teenage servant, allegedly possessed, while in delirium had quietly babbled a language that finally was recognized to be Syriac. Karras forced himself to think of the excitement it had caused, of how finally it was learned that the girl had at one time been employed in a boarding house
where one of the lodgers was a student of theology, who on the eve of examinations would pace in his room and walk up and down stairs while reciting his Syriac lessons aloud. And the girl had overheard them.
Take it easy. Don't get burned.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch? Asked Karas.
More games.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch?
The Jesuit repeated, his pulse still throbbing with that distant hope.
Natürlich, the demon answered, leering. Mirabile dictu, wouldn't you agree?
The Jesuit's heart leaped up. Not only German, but Latin, and in context.
Quod nomen mihi est?
He asked quickly. What is my name?
Karas.
And now the priest rushed on with excitement.
Ubi sum?
Where am I?
In cubiculo.
In a room.
Et ubi est cubiculum?
And where is the room?
In domo.
In a house.
Ubi est Burke Dennings?
Where is Burke Dennings?
Mortuus.
He is dead.
Quomodo mortuus est?
How did he die?
Inventus. Et capite? Reverso!
He was found with his head turned around.
Quis accidit eum?
Who killed him?
Regan.
Quomodo ea accidit ilium?
Dic mihi exacte.
How did she kill him? Tell me in detail.
Ah, well, that's sufficient excitement for now, said the demon with a grin.
Yes, sufficient altogether, I would think.
Though, of course, it will occur to you, I suppose. I mean, you. You being you. That while you were asking your question in Latin, you were mentally formulating answers in Latin.
Yes, very funny. All unconscious, of course.
Yes, whatever would we do without unconsciousness, Karas? You see what I'm driving at? I cannot speak Latin at all. I read your mind. I merely plucked responses from your head.
Karas felt an instant dismay as his certainty crumbled. He felt tantalized and frustrated now by the nagging doubt that had been planted in his brain. The demon chuckled.
Yes,
I knew that would occur to you, Karas, it croaked. That's why I'm so fond of you, dear morsel. Yes, that is why I cherish all reasonable men.
The demon's head had tilted back in a wild spate of laughter. The Jesuit's mind raced rapidly, desperately, formulating questions to which no single answer was correct, but rather many.
But maybe I'd think of all of them, he realized. Then ask a question that you don't know the answer to, he reasoned.
He could check the answer later to see if it was correct. He waited for the laughter to ebb, and then smoke.
Quam profundus est imus oceanus Indicus?
What is the depth of the Indian Ocean at its deepest point?
The demon's eyes glittered. La plume de matante. Responde Latine.
Bonjour. Bonne nuit.
Quam?
Karas broke off as the eyes rolled upward into their sockets, and the gibberish entity appeared. Impatient, frustrated, Karas demanded,
Let me speak to the demon again.
No answer. Only the breathing from an alien shore.
Qui est tu?
He snapped hoarsely in a fraying voice. Who are you? Only silence. The breathing.
Let me speak to Burke Dennings.
A hiccup. Sputtery breathing. Another hiccup.
Let me speak to Burke Dennings. The hiccuping, regular and wrenching, continued. Karras lowered his head and shook it, then trudged to an overstuffed chair where he sat, leaned back and closed his eyes, tense, tormented, and waiting. Time passed. Karras drowsed, then jerked his head up. Stay awake! And then, with blinking heavy lids, he looked over at Reagan, not hiccuping now, her eyes closed. Was she asleep? Karras stood up, walked over to the bed, reached down, and felt Reagan's pulse. Then, stooping over, he examined her lips. They were parched. He straightened up and waited a little time, and then at last he left the room and went down to the kitchen in search of Sharon. He found her at the table, eating soup and a sandwich. "Oh, can I fix you something to eat, Father Karras?" she asked him. "You must be hungry." "No, I'm not, Karras answered. Sitting down, he reached over and picked up a pencil and pad by Sharon's typewriter. "She's been hiccuping," he told her. "Have you had any compazine prescribed?" "Oh, yeah, we've got some." Karras was writing on the pad. "Then tonight give her half of a 25-milligram suppository." "Okay." "She's beginning to dehydrate," Karras continued, "so I'm switching her to intravenous feedings. First thing in the morning, call a medical supply house and have them deliver these right away." He slid the pad across the table to Sharon. "In the meantime, she's sleeping, so you could start her on a sustagen feeding right now." Sharon nodded. "Okay, I will." Spooning soup, she turned the pad around and looked at the list. Karras watched her. Then he frowned in concentration. "Sharon." "Yeah?" "You're her tutor." "Yeah, that's right." "Have you taught her any Latin?" "Latin? No, I don't know any Latin." "Why?" "Any German?" No, only French." "What level? La plume de ma tante?" "Yeah, pretty much." "But no German or Latin?"
"No."
"But the Engstroms now, don't they sometimes speak German?"
"Oh, well, sure."
"Around Reagan?"
Standing up, Sharon shrugged.
"Well, sometimes, I suppose." She started toward the kitchen sink with her plates as she added, "As a matter of fact, now that I think about it, I'm pretty sure." "Have you ever studied Latin?" Karras asked her. Sharon giggled as she answered, "Me? Latin?" No, I haven't." "But you'd recognize the general sound?"
"Yeah, I guess."
She rinsed the soup bowl and put it in the rack.
"Has she ever spoken Latin in your presence?"
"Reagan?"
"Yes, since her illness."
"Oh, no, never."
"Any language at all? I mean, other than English?" Sharon turned off the faucet, looking thoughtful.
"Well, I might have imagined it, I guess, but..."
"But what?"
"Well, I think..." Sharon frowned. "Well, I could have sworn I heard her talking in Russian once."
Karras stared, his throat dry.
"Do you speak it?" he asked.
"Oh, well, so-so. I took 2 years of it in college, that's all."
Karras sagged. "Then Reagan did pick the Latin from my brain." Staring bleakly, he lowered his brow into his hand and into doubt. Telepathy more common in states of great tension. Speaking always in a language known to someone in the room. "Thinks the same things I'm thinking. Bonjour, la plume de ma tante. Bonne nuit." With thoughts such as these, Karras sadly watched blood turning back into wine. What to do? Get some sleep, then come back and try again. Try again.
He stood up and looked blearily at Sharon. She was leaning with her back against the sink, her arms folded, as she pensively and curiously watched him.
"I'm going over to the residence," he told her. "As soon as Reagan's awake, I'd like a call." "Yes, Father, I'll call you. And the composite, okay? You won't forget?" She shook her head. "No, I'll take care of it right away."
Karis nodded, and with his hands in hip pockets, he looked down, trying to think of what he might have forgotten to tell Sharon. Always something to be done. Always something overlooked when even everything was done. "Father, what's going on?" he heard the secretary asking him somberly. "What is it? What's really going on with Rags?"
Karis lifted up eyes that were haunted and seared. "I don't know," he said emptily. "I really don't know." He turned and walked out of the kitchen.
As he passed through the entry hall, Karis heard footsteps coming up rapidly behind him.
"Father Karis." Karis turned and saw Carl with his sweater. "Very sorry," said the houseman as he handed it over. "I was thinking to finish much before, but I forget. I am sorry."
He handed the sweater to Karis. The vomit stains were gone, and it had a sweet smell.
"That was thoughtful of you, Carl," the priest said to him gently. "Thank you. Oh, thank you, Father Karis." Carl spoke with a tremor in his voice, his eyes full. "Thank you for your helping Miss Reagan." Then averting his head, self-conscious, Carl turned and walked swiftly away.
As Karis watched him, he remembered him in Kinderman's car. Why?
More mystery now, more confusion. Wearily, Karis turned around and opened the door. It was night. Despairing, he stepped out of darkness into darkness.
He crossed to the residence, groping toward sleep, but decided to stop by Dyer's room. He knocked on the door, heard "Advance and be proselytized" from within, and entering found Dyer typing on his IBM Selectric. Karis flopped down on the edge of Dyer's cot as the younger Jesuit continued to type.
"Hey, Joe."
"Yeah, I'm listening, listening. What is it?"
"Do you happen to know of anyone who's done a formal exorcism?"
"Joe Louis Max Schmeling, June 22nd, 1938. Joe gets serious.
"No, you get serious. Exorcism? You kidding me?"
Karis made no answer, and for moments he watched expressionlessly as Dyer continued to type, until at last he got up and walked to the door.
"Yeah, Joe," he said. "I was kidding."
"Yeah,
I thought so."
"See you around the campus. Find funnier jokes."
Karis walked down the hall, and as he entered his room, he looked down and saw a pink message slip on the floor. He picked it up. From Frank, a home number. "Please call." Karis picked up the telephone and requested that a call be put through to the Institute Director's number, and as he waited, he looked down at his free hand, the right one. It was trembling with desperate hope.
"Hello?"
Piping voice, a young boy.
"May I speak to your father, please?"
"Yep, just a minute."
Phone clattering, then quickly picked up. Still the boy.
"Who is this?"
"Father Karis."
"Father Carrots?"
"Karis, Father Karis." Down went the phone again. Karis lifted the tremulous hand, lightly touching his fingertips to his brow. Phone noise.
"Father Karis?"
"Yeah, oh, hello, Frank. I've been trying to reach you."
"I'm sorry, I've been working on your tapes at the house."
"Oh, are you finished?"
"Yes, I am.
By the way, this is pretty weird stuff."
"Yes, I know," said Karis, as he strained to flatten the tension in his voice. So what's the story so far? What have you found?
Well, this type token ratio first.
Yes, Frank?
Now, I didn't have enough of a sampling to be absolutely accurate, you understand. But I'd say it's pretty close, or, you know, or at least it's as close as you can get with these things.
Well, at any rate, the two different voices on the tapes, I would say, are probably separate personalities.
Probably?
Well, I wouldn't want to swear to it in court. In fact, the variance is really pretty minimal.
Minimal, Karras repeated dully.
Well, there goes the ball game, he thought. And, Frank, what about the gibberish, he asked. Is it any kind of language? Frank chuckled. What's funny? Asked the Jesuit moodily.
Was this really some sneaky psychological testing, Father?
What do you mean?
Well, I guess you got your tapes mixed around or something. It's, Frank, is it a language or not?
Oh, I'd say it was a language, all right.
Dumbfounded, Karras stiffened.
Are you kidding?
No, no, I'm not.
What's the language?
It's English.
For a moment, Karras stared blankly. And when he spoke, there was an edge to his voice.
Frank, we seem to have a very poor connection. Or would you like to let me in on the joke?
You got your tape recorder there?
It was sitting on Karras's desk.
Yes, I do.
Has it got a reverse play position?
Why? Has it got one?
Just a second. Irritable, Karras set down the phone and took the top off the tape recorder to check it.
Yes, it's got one, Frank. So what's this all about?
Put your tape on the machine and play it backward.
What?
You've got gremlins.
Frank chuckled good-naturedly.
Listen, play it and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Good night, Father.
Night, Frank.
Have fun.
Oh, yeah, right.
Karras hung up. He looked baffled. He hunted up the gibberish tape and placed it into the recorder. First he ran it forward and nodded his head. No mistake, it was gibberish. He let it run through to the end and then played it in reverse. He heard the voice speaking backward, and then Reagan's demon voice.
Marin, Marin, Marin. Let us be.
Let us. English. Senseless, but still English. How on earth could she do that? Karras marveled.
He listened to it all, rewound the tape and played it through again, and again, and then realized that the order of speech was inverted. He stopped the tape, rewound it, and with a pencil and a writing tablet at hand, he sat down at the desk and began to play the tape from the beginning, while transcribing the words, working laboriously and long with almost constant stops and starts of the tape recorder. When finally it was done, he made another transcription on a second sheet of paper, reversing the order of the words. Then he leaned back and read it.
Danger. Not yet. Something unintelligible. We'll die. Little time.
Now the unintelligible.
Let her die.
No, no, it is sweet in the body. I feel there is unintelligible.
Better
unintelligible than the void.
I fear the priest. Give us time. Fear the priest. He is
unintelligible.
No, not this one, the
unintelligible, the one who unintelligible.
He is ill. Ah, the blood, feel the blood, how it sings.
Karras asked on the tape, who are you? With the answer,
I am no one, I am no one.
Then Karras, is that your name? And the answer,
I have no name. I am no one.
Let us be.
Let us warm in the body. Do not, unintelligible, from the body into void, into unintelligible. Leave us, let us be, Caris, Marin, Marin.
Again and again, Caris read his transcription over, haunted by its tone, by the feeling that more than one person was speaking, until finally repetition itself dulled the words into commonness, and he set down the transcription and rubbed at his face, at his eyes, at his thoughts. Not an unknown language, and writing backward with facility was hardly paranormal or even unusual, but speaking backward, adjusting and altering the phonetics so that playing them backward would make them intelligible. Wasn't such a performance beyond the reach of even a hyper-stimulated intellect? The accelerated unconscious referred to by Jung? No, something at the rim of memory. Then he remembered. He went to his shelves for a book, Jung's Psychology and Pathology of So-Called Occult Phenomena. Something similar here, he was thinking, as he rapidly searched through the pages of the book. What was it? He found it. An account of an experiment with automatic writing, in which the unconscious of the subject seemed able to answer his questions with anagrams. Anagrams. He propped the book open on the desk, leaned over, and read an account of a portion of the experiment. Third day. What is man?
Tefi hasel esble lias.
Is that an anagram?
Yes.
How many words does it contain?
Five.
What is the first word?
Si.
What is the second word? See? Shall I interpret it myself?
Try to.
The subject found the solution, the life is less able. He was astonished at this intellectual pronouncement, which seemed to him to prove the existence of an intelligence independent of his own. He therefore went on to ask,
Who are you? Clelia.
Are you a woman?
Yes.
Have you lived on Earth?
No.
Will you come to life?
Yes.
When?
In 6 years.
Why are you conversing with me?
E if Clelia L.
The subject interpreted this answer as an anagram for I, Clelia, feel. The fourth day. Am I the one who answers the questions?
Yes.
Is Clelia there?
No.
Who is there then?
Nobody.
Does Clelia exist at all?
No.
Then who was I talking to yesterday?
With nobody.
Caris stopped reading and shook his head. There was nothing paranormal here, he thought. Only proof of the limitless abilities of the mind. He reached for a cigarette, sat down, and lit it.
I am no one. Many.
Where did it come from, Caris wondered, this eerie content of Reagan's speech? From the same place Clelia had come from? Emergent personality?
Marin. Marin.
The blood.
His eyes haunted. Caris glanced at his copy of Satan and moodily leafed to the opening inscription, Let not the dragon be my leader. Closing his eyes as he exhaled smoke, Caris lifted a fist to his mouth as he coughed, and aware of his throat feeling raw and inflamed, he crushed out the cigarette in an ashtray. Exhausted, he slowly and awkwardly got up, flicked out the room light, shuttered his window blinds, kicked off his shoes, and collapsed face down on his narrow cot. Fevered fragments spun and tumbled through his mind. Reagan, Kinderman, Dennings. What to do? He must help. He had to help. But how? Try the bishop with what little he had? He didn't think so. He could never convincingly argue the case. He thought of undressing, of getting under the covers. Too tired. This burden. He wanted to be free.
Let us be.
As he began the slow drift into granite sleep, Karras's lips moved almost imperceptibly, forming the soundless words, "Let me be." And then suddenly he was lifting his head, awakened by adenoidal breathing and the soft sound of cellophane being crinkled, and opening his eyes, he saw a stranger in his room, a slightly overweight, middle-aged, freckle-faced priest with thin strands of red hair that were combed straight back on a balding head. Sitting in the overstuffed corner chair, he was watching Karras and tearing off the seal from the packet of Galois cigarettes. The priest smiled. "Well, hello." Karras swung his legs around and sat up. "Yeah, hello and goodbye," Karras growled. "Who are you, and what the fuck are you doing in my room?" "Oh, look, I'm sorry, but when I knocked and you didn't answer, I saw the door was unlocked, so I just thought I'd come in and wait. And then there you were." The priest gestured to a pair of crutches tilted and leaned against the wall near the chair. I couldn't wait for very long in the hall, you see. I can stand for so long, and then at some point I've just got to sit. I hope you'll forgive me. Listen, I'm Ed Lucas, by the way. Your father, president, suggested that I see you." Slightly frowning, Karras tilted his head to the side. "Is that Lucas?" "Yes, it's Lucas all the time," said the priest, his grin displaying long and nicotine-stained teeth. He'd extracted a cigarette from the packet and was slipping a hand into his pocket for a lighter. Mind if I smoke?" No, go ahead. I'm a smoker." Yes, Lucas said as he glanced at a crush of cigarette butts in an ashtray on the end table next to his chair. The priest held out the cigarette packet to Karras. Try a Galois?" No, thanks." "Look, you said that Tom Birmingham sent you?" "Good old Tom. Yeah, we were buds. We were in the same high school class at Regis, and after that we did our tertianship together at St. Andrews on Hudson. Yeah, Tom recommended that I see you, so I took a greyhound from New York. I'm from Fordham, by the way." Karras's mood abruptly lifted. He said, "Oh, New York. Is this about my request for reassignment?" "Reassignment? I don't know anything at all about that. It's a personal matter," said the priest. Karras's shoulders slumped with his hopes. "Well, okay then," he said in a tone more subdued. He stood up and walked over to the straight-backed wooden chair behind his desk, turned it around, sat down, and began to measure Lucas with a clinically appraising eye. To Karras, from this closer vantage, the priest's black suit looked rumpled and baggy, even seedy. There was dandruff on the shoulders. The priest had pulled a cigarette out of its package, and now he lit it with the leaping tall flame of a Zippo lighter that he seemed to have produced unnoticed from a pocket, like a magician's sleight of hand, and then blew out a stream of moody, bluish-gray smoke, which he watched with what looked like deep satisfaction as he drawled, "It's just nothing like a Galois for the nerves." "Are you nervous, Ed?"
"A little."
"Well, okay then, let's get to it," said Karras. "You go ahead and lay it out for me, Ed. How can I help you?"
Lucas studied Karras with a look of concern,
You look exhausted, he said. Yeah, listen, perhaps it's best if we meet up tomorrow. What do you say? Then he quickly added, yeah, yes, yes, most definitely tomorrow. Could you hand those to me, please? He had reached out a hand to the crutches. No, Karras told him. I'm fine, Ed, just fine. Leaning forward with his hands clasped together between his knees, Karras scanned the priest's face as he told them, procrastination is what we often call resistance. Lucas lifted an eyebrow, in his eyes a faint hint of what might have been bemusement. Oh, is that so? Yes, it's so. Karras lowered his gaze to Lucas's legs. Does that depress you? He asked. What do you mean? Oh, my legs. Oh, well, sometimes, I suppose. Congenital, Ed? No, it happened in a fall. For a moment, Karras studied his visitor's face. That faint, secret smile. Had he seen it yet again? Well, that's too bad, Karras murmured sympathetically. Oh, well, that's the world we've inherited, not so, reacted Lucas, the Galois cigarette still dangling from a corner of his mouth. He took it from his lips between two fingers and lamented amid an exhale of smoke. Oh, well. So, okay, Ed, let's get to it, okay? He didn't come here all the way from New York to play dodgeball with me, that's for sure, so let's open up now. Come on, tell me everything. Everything. Open up. Lucas gently shook his head and looked aside. Oh, well, it's such a long story, he began. But then he had put a fist to his mouth, and a new spell of coughing racked him. You want a drink? Karras asked. His eyes watering, the priest shook his head. Oh, no, I'm fine, he said chokingly. Really? Really? As the spasm seemed to pass. He looked down and brushed cigarette ash from the front of his jacket. Filthy damn habit, he grumbled, as Karras noticed now what looked to be a soft-boiled egg stain on the black clergy shirt the priest wore beneath his jacket. Oh, okay, Ed. What's the problem? Karras asked. Lucas lifted his gaze to him and said, you. Karras blinked. He said, me? Yes, Damien. You. Tom's terribly worried about you. Karras stared at Lucas steadily now, with the beginning of realization. For in his eyes and in his voice, there was a deep compassion. Ed, what do you do up at Fordham? Karras asked. I counsel, said the priest. You counsel? Yes, Damien. I'm a psychiatrist. Karras stared. A psychiatrist, he echoed blankly. Lucas looked aside. Ah, well, where do I begin? He breathed out reluctantly. I'm not sure. It's so tricky. Very tricky. Well, let's see what we can do, he said softly, leaning over and tamping out his Galois in the ashtray. But then again, you're a pro, he said, looking up. And at times it's best to put things on the table straight away. The priest had begun coughing into his fist again. Damn, I'm so sorry. Really. The coughing ended. Lucas eyed Karras somberly. Look, it's all this crazy business with you and the McNeils. Karras reacted with surprise. The McNeils, he marveled. Listen, how could you possibly know about that? There's no way that Tom would ever let that out. No way. It would be harmful to the family. There are sources. Sources? What sources? Such as who? Such as what? Does it matter, said the priest. Not at all. All that matters is your health and your emotional stability, both of which are clearly already in danger. And this thing with the McNeils will only stress it all the more. So the provincial is ordering you to break it off. Break it off for your own sake, Karras, as well as for the good of the order. The priest's bushy eyebrows had gathered inward, almost touching. and he'd lowered his head so that his stare and his visage seemed somehow threatening.
"Break it off," he warned, "before it leads to some greater catastrophe, before things get even worse, much worse. We don't want any more desecrations now, Damien, do we?"
Karis stared at his visitor in bafflement, and then in shock. "The desecrations? And what in the hell are you talking about? What does my mental health have to do with them?"
Lucas leaned back in his chair. "Oh, come on," he scoffed cynically. "You join the Jesuits, leave your poor mother to die all alone in an abject poverty. And so who would someone hate for all of that unconsciously, if not the Catholic Church?" Here the priest leaned forward again, hunching over as he hissed,
"Don't be obtuse. Stay away from the McNeils."
His eyes tight, his head angled in surmise, Karis rose and stared down at the priest, demanding huskily, "Who in the hell are you, pal? Who are you?" The soft ringing of the telephone on Karis's desk drew a swift, alarmed glance from Father Lucas.
"Watch out for Sharon," he warned Karis sharply.
And then abruptly the phone was ringing loudly, so that Karis awakened and realized he'd been dreaming. Groggy, he got up from his cot, stumbled over to a light switch, flicked it on, and then moved to the desk and picked up the phone. It was Sharon. "What time was it?" he asked her.
"A little after 3. Could he come to the house right away?"
"Ah, oh, God," Karis inwardly groaned. "And yet..."
"Yes," he said. "Yes, he would come."
And once again he felt trapped, smothered, enmeshed. He lurched into his white-tiled bathroom, where he splashed cold water on his face, and, drying off, he suddenly remembered Father Lucas and the dream. What did it mean?
Perhaps nothing.
Yes, perhaps nothing. He would think about it later. When about to leave his room, at the door Karis stopped, turned around, and came back for a black woolen sweater, pulling it over his head, and as he tugged it down, he abruptly stopped, numbly staring at the end table by the corner chair. Taking a breath, and then a slow step forward, he reached down to the ashtray, picked up a cigarette butt, and then stood motionless for a time as he held it up to his stunned surmise. It was a Galois. Racing thoughts, suppositions, a coldness, then an urgency.
"Watch out for Sharon."
Karis placed the Galois butt back into the ashtray, hurried from his room and down the hall and then out onto Prospect Street, where the air was thin and still and damp. He passed the steps, crossed over to the opposite side diagonally, and found Sharon watching and waiting for him at the McNeil house's open front door, looking frightened and bewildered. One hand held a flashlight, while a hand at her neck held together the edges of a blanket that was draped around her shoulders. "I'm sorry, Father," she huskily whispered, as the Jesuit entered the house,
"but I thought you ought to see this."
"See what?"
Sharon soundlessly closed the door.
"I'll have to show you. Let's be quiet now. I don't want to wake up Chris. She shouldn't see this."
She beckoned and Karis followed her, tiptoeing quietly up the stairs to Reagan's bedroom. Entering, the Jesuit felt chilled. The room was icy. Frowning, he turned a questioning look to Sharon, and she nodded her head and whispered,
"Yes, Father.
Yes,
the heat's on."
They turned and stared at Reagan, at the whites of her eyes glowing eerily in dim lamplight. She seemed to be in a coma, heavy breathing, motionless. The nasogastric tubing was in place, and the sustagen was slowly seeping into her body. Sharon moved quietly toward the bedside. Karis followed, still staggered by the cold. When they were standing by the bed, He saw beads of perspiration on Reagan's forehead, glanced down, and saw her wrists gripped firmly in the leather restraining straps. Sharon bent over the bed, gently pulling the top of Reagan's pink and white pajama top wide apart, and an overwhelming pity hit Karis at the sight of the wasted chest, the protruding ribs where one might count the remaining weeks or days of her life. He felt Sharon's haunted stare upon him.
I don't know if it stopped, she whispered, but watch. Just keep looking at her chest.
Sharon turned on the flashlight and shone it on Reagan's bare chest, and the Jesuit, puzzled, followed her gaze. Then silence, Reagan's slightly whistling breathing, watching the cold. Then the Jesuit's brows knitted tightly together as he saw something happening to the skin of Reagan's chest, a faint redness, but in sharp definition. He peered down closer.
There, it's coming, Sharon whispered sharply.
Abruptly, the goose flesh on Karis's arms was not from the icy cold in the room, but from what he was seeing on Reagan's chest, from the bas-relief script rising up in clear letters of raised and blood-red skin. Two words. Help me. A wide stare riveted to the words. Sharon's breath came frosty as she whispered,
that's her handwriting, Father.
At 9 that morning, Karis went to the president of Georgetown University and asked for permission to seek an exorcism. He received it, and immediately afterward went to the bishop of the diocese, who listened with grave attention to all that Karis had to say.
You're convinced that it's genuine? The bishop asked finally.
Well, I've made a prudent judgment that it meets the conditions set forth in the ritual, Karis answered evasively. He still did not dare to believe. Not his mind, but his heart had tugged him to this moment. Pity and the hope for a cure through suggestion.
You would want to do the exorcism yourself?
Karis felt elation, saw the door swinging open to fields, to escape from the crushing weight of caring and that meeting each twilight with the ghost of his faith.
And yet, yes, Your Grace, he answered.
How's your health?
My health is fine, Your Grace. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been involved with this sort of thing before?
No, Your Grace, I haven't.
Well, we'll see. Might be best to have a man with experience. Aren't too many these days, but perhaps someone back from the foreign missions. Let's see who's around. In the meantime, I'll call you as soon as we know.
When Karis had left him, the bishop called the president of Georgetown University, and they talked about Karis for the second time that day.
Well, he does know the background, said the president at a point in their conversation. I doubt there's any danger in just having him assist. You know, in any case, there's got to be a psychiatrist present.
What about the exorcists? Any ideas? I'm a blank.
Well, now Lancaster Merrin's around.
Merrin?
Had a notion he was over in Iraq. I think I read he was working on a dig around Nineveh.
Yes, down around Mosul. Yeah, that's right, Mike, but he finished, and he came back here, about, I think, 3 or 4 months ago. He's at Woodstock.
Oh, teaching?
No, he's working on another book.
God help us.
Don't you think he's too old, though? How's his health?
Well, it must be all right. He wouldn't still be running around digging up tombs, don't you think?
Yeah, I suppose so. Besides, he's had experience, Mike.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well,
at least that's the word.
When was that? This experience, I mean?
Oh, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I think, in Africa. Supposedly, the exorcism lasted for months. Heard it damn near killed him. Well, in that case, I doubt he'd want to do another one. We do what we're told here, Mike. All the rebels are over there with you seculars. Thanks for reminding me. Come on, what do you think? Listen, I'm going to leave it up to you and the provincial. Early that quietly waiting evening, a young scholastic preparing for the priesthood wandered the grounds of Woodstock Seminary in Maryland. He was searching for a slender, gray-haired old Jesuit. He found him on a pathway, strolling through a grove. He handed him a telegram. His manner serene, the tall old priest thanked him and then turned to renew his contemplation, to continue his walk through a nature that he loved. Now and then he would pause to hear the song of a robin, to watch a bright butterfly hover on a branch. He did not open and read the telegram. He knew what it said. He had read it in the dust of the temples of Nineveh. He was ready. He continued his farewells.